Welcome to our session on transboundary pollution and wildlife. My name is Sharon Ostock. I'm a freelancer out of Toronto and an SCGA board member. Before I introduce our panel, I just want to give you a little bit of context for our discussion today. We're going to be using a flathead as sort of a case study for looking at transboundary wildlife and pollution. Case study, I think, is fairly rich in story ideas. You guys all have a map, so that'll help orient you. The Flathead Valley is just north of where we are right now. You'll see it stretches across BC and Montana. It's been called one of the most diverse and ecologically intact ecosystems in the world. This area also has huge coal and methane reserves. So as you might expect, the valley is what some commentators call a real Western-style dust up. For years, part of the reason for that is for years, BC accepted a steady stream of proposals for oil and gas and coal methane development, as well as mining and logging development. That led to conflict with folks on both sides of the border. In fact, when Montana Senator Max Baucus, is that right? Baucus, thank you, took up the cause of protecting the valley, Bill Bennett, one of BC's more colorful cabinet ministers, who represents the Flathead, apparently ran into him in the street in Fernie and told him in no uncertain terms he was not welcome. And later in the legislature, Bennett said, and I quote, "What unscrupulous, traitorous twit sunk so low as to invite this guy to BC?" it's in their version of Hansard. They got it recorded there. The valley's fate was also recently a topic of discussion between President Obama and Prime Minister Harper at the G20 summit in Toronto. I think they were a little more civil than Bill Bennett was. That's probably because of a major turnaround since then. BC, in February of this year, signed a memorandum of understanding with Montana to protect the Flathead from oil and gas and mining activity. And the same month, BC actually outright said they were going to ban mining and oil and gas development. And now the U.S. Senate is holding hearings on banning industrial development on this side of the border, the Flathead as well. So our panelists are going to give us some insight into how that came about, what's going on, how it could affect transboundary pollution and wildlife, and including the valley's grizzlies, which have the highest inland population density on the continent. I expect we might also hear that despite the cross-border memorandum of understanding and BC's ban on resource development, that not is all as it may seem. I'd like to introduce you to our panelists now. We have beside me Will Hammerquist. He's the Glacier Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association here in Montana. And he, along with Casey, have been very involved in lobbying on the Flathead. And Will is also running as a Democrat for the Montana Legislature in this fall's election. We also have Chris Servine. He's the Grizzly Bear Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's responsible for coordinating all the research and management on grizzly bears in the lower 48 states and working with biologists in Alberta and BC. He's also a professor here at the University of Montana, where he teaches international wildlife conservation. And to our on the far side here, we've got Casey Brennan. He is the Southern Rockies Program Manager for WildSight, and that's a BC-based environmental group. And Casey, as well, was very involved in efforts that led to the BC government's ban. And I'd hope to have a representative from the BC government here today. That didn't happen despite repeated emails and phone calls. I'm sure they know my name very well in the BC government. But we may touch on why it is that nobody came from the BC government. We'll see. I want to let our panelists begin with a very short presentation, no more than 5 minutes. And then we will have a moderator discussion to follow, and I'll leave plenty of time for questions at the end. So if you can just jot down your questions and keep them till the end, that would be great. So maybe I'll have Will start.
Thank you, Sharon. Good morning, everyone. Before I start, I want to take one moment of personal privilege. I have two sisters who are students at the University of Montana right now. One's pursuing her doctorate, and the other's working on her undergraduate. They got up early this morning to come see me. So, yeah. But Like Sharon said, my name is Will Hammerquist. I work for the nonprofit National Parks Conservation Association, which is actually a national organization based out of Washington, D.C., which has a pretty simple and straightforward mission to protect and enhance America's national parks. And I run the Glacier Field Office out of Whitefish, Montana, which is about 100 miles north of here. And I guess I have 5 minutes real briefly. You know, Chris is the scientist here, Casey's the Canadian. I'll give a perspective as an activist on the U.S. side who's been working on this issue. And one thing Sharon asked me to speak to is, you know, why did this happen? This issue has been a point of contention. And there's this map here which does provide a point of reference. So you can see the watershed boundaries in blue. The headwaters, about an upper third, is in British Columbia. Of the U.S. portion, half is in Glacier National Park, and the other half is in the Whitefish Range in Forest Service hands for the very most part. And this has been an issue that's been around for 30 years. And it's almost reached a point where, you know, it was an intergenerational, international environmental conflict. And why was it resolved in 2010, or why is such tremendous steps towards resolution happened this year? And I guess I'll just speak really briefly about what happened. Sharon touched on it. It began in early 2010 with an announcement during the Olympics by British Columbia Premier Gordon Campbell that British Columbia was placing their portion of the watershed off limits to all types of mining, fossil fuel extraction, and coal bed methane, oil and gas drilling. So really you had a very significant policy shift in British Columbia, which is subsequently followed at the state level in Montana with a similar ban on all state-owned lands in the watershed. And then Montana senators introduced legislation to accomplish the same on U.S. federal lands. That legislation has now passed out of the Senate committee and is waiting action on the floor of the U.S. Senate. And a final piece of this, which I really think speaks to some level of the social consensus we have around this issue, particularly on the U.S. side, four oil major companies, Exxon, Conoco, Phillips, and several others, have voluntarily relinquished over 200,000 acres of leases that they had on the U.S. side on federal lands, existing oil and gas leases. They are giving them back at no cost to U.S. taxpayers and saying, you know, this is a place we don't think is appropriate for fossil fuel extraction. And there are some really tremendous values in this valley, which I think Chris will be able to speak to very well. So why did this happen? After 30 years, I would put credit maybe in five areas. One was a very strategic long-term investment by a funding foundation that invested in this issue on both sides of the border, both in the capital in Victoria, in local communities in British Columbia and Montana. I think the funding foundation made a very strategic investment to help realize this goal by raising public awareness. Secondly, there was a growing body of scientific evidence. If the conservation science was clearly around protecting this core habitat, and that growing body of evidence really lended itself to the policy decisions we saw made. Third reason, you had a very diverse citizen coalition in both countries that supported protection. I think first and foremost in Southeast British Columbia, over 70%+ of folks, you know, according to very accurate polling, opposed mining in the valley. And consensus on the U.S. side was nearly universal. I mean, the potential impacts to a national park, that really does have catch for people in terms of national parks being part of our national identity and our cultural story. The fourth reason, I think, comes back to internationalism. Waterton Glacier is the world's first international peace park. The conservation organizations that have been working on this issue moved forward a petition to the UNESCO World Heritage Committee to have the park listed as an endangered World Heritage Site. That's been successfully employed in the past around Yellowstone with the New World Mine, also in Glacier Bay and the Tatashini in Alaska, British Columbia in the north. So that's a very powerful tool when you bring in international social norms, particularly around the world's first peace park, which is a model throughout the world. Final reason there, two reasons perhaps. I think, you know, if you look at why history happens, there's maybe two schools of thoughts out there. One is, you know, maybe Jerry Diamond's, you can explain it through geography, natural resources. There's also, you know, what role does leadership play, individual leadership, you know? How did Napoleon as an individual influence the course of Europe's history? And I think there was some unique leadership that happened both with Premier Gordon Campbell, Montana's Governor Brian Schweitzer. We had an alignment of leaders who believed this could happen at this particular time. And the final reason was just, I think, some random fortunate synergy. We had the 100th anniversary of Glacier National Park this year, the 125th anniversary of Canada's National Park System, timed up with the Olympics being hosted in Vancouver, British Columbia. So there was an international stage for the political actors to announce protection of the world's first peace park. So there was just some fortune there, I guess. So I think those are the reasons why it happened. I hope that's a brief summary of what happened, and it's probably 5 minutes for you.
That's great. Yes, yeah. Thank you.
I had a question following on that.
Can we just jot down your questions? We'll save a lot of time. I promise you, a lot of time. Chris?
Okay. This area is probably the most important transboundary wildlife area between the U.S. and Canada, anywhere along this very long and elaborate border. And the reasons for that are that we've got transboundary fisheries populations like bull trout, which spawn in B.C. and spend most of their lives in Montana. We've got grizzly bear populations, which have dual citizenship. The animals go back and forth across the border on a regular basis. Wolverine populations, wolf populations, and all that in this system of two big national parks, Waterton and Glacier, and this intact ecosystem. The flathead drainage, which starts in Montana and extends into British Columbia, is fairly unique in that it does not have any development in the BC portion. So in the BC portion, you don't have any residences to speak of, you don't have any town sites, you don't have any paved roads. There's been timber harvest in there for many years, but the lack of site development by humans has contributed to extremely healthy wildlife populations in this area. And the transboundary nature of many of these wildlife species, I think, was a highlight for why there was a lot of concern on the U.S. side to this potential for development. When the development potential arose again a few years ago, there was a consensus among U.S. scientists that we had to build a case for why it was important to protect this area. And you had aquatic scientists who were concerned about water quality issues, because if you look at the headwaters of the Flathead, where the proposed mine was going to be, it takes 48 hours for the water to get from that mine site to Flathead Lake, which is one of the most important lakes in western United States. And you have all these bull trout populations that spend their lives essentially in Montana, but move across the border and spawn in British Columbia in the Flathead drainage. And then you have all these terrestrial populations of animals like grizzly bears and wolves and wolverines, and seasonal movements for elk and moose populations and various others that go across the border there. And so you have this unique ecosystem that has been surviving for a long time because of the lack of development on the Canadian side. And if the development went forward, then all those things would be dramatically negatively affected. And we worked together with our colleagues in British Columbia to try to build a good scientific case as to what the problems would be with these issues. I think it's a credit to the politicians that they recognized that this was something that was going to be pretty difficult to do. And I think the real key point from my point of view is that we built a scientific case that showed that scientifically this would have negative impacts on many resources if this area was developed for energy. But the key thing, in my view, is that the local people in British Columbia, in this area, were against the development of the Flathead. And many of the miners that live in there, and there are coal mines in the Elk Valley, which is just north of Highway 3, an adjacent drainage, but not draining into the U.S. directly in that area. All those miners in there used the Flathead as a recreation area, a hunting area and a fishing area, and they didn't want to see the same type of mining development that they worked at move into the place that they recreated at. And so the local support was not there for mining, along with the negative pressure from the U.S., the scientific facts that it would have negative resource effects across the border. And there was a lot of political pressure from the U.S. Senators. Governor Schweitzer stepped up from Montana and made a lot of comments to the B.C. government about the negative effects of this. And altogether, plus those things, plus that the fact that the local people were not in favor of it, I think contributed to the B.C. government making this decision. Now, from a scientific point of view, I think this is a great victory. And we look at this as a huge advance to conservation in the transboundary area. We, in the U.S., are dependent on what happens in Canada for most of our large carnivore populations, because we've evaporated our large carnivores into small island populations. And the transboundary nature of these populations are what gives these populations resilience. And if we lose our connectivity across the border in these key transboundary areas like this one, then we would end up with island populations south of the border. And no matter how much effort we would invest through the Endangered Species Act in protecting our species, there's very little that we could do to maintain healthy populations without healthy populations across the border in BC. And so we view this as a great victory to see this kind of thing, this decision to not put resource development, at least energy, into that area. And, you know, I want to note that we are continuing to work in this area to build scientific information on the status of population. We're starting a wolverine population study in the upper flathead. We've done grizzly bear work looking at the cumulative effects of development along Highway 3, which is that north-south corridor just north of the border there. And if that north-south, or excuse me, east-west corridor on Highway 3 is intensively and continues to be intensively developed, potential is that that could fracture the flathead drainage and the adjacent area south of the border from our populations to the north in BC and Alberta. And we don't want to fracture any further our grizzly bear and wolverine populations. So we're continuing to work very closely with our BC colleagues and trying to build a case to understand what human activities will fracture the populations there and what we can put in place for management actions to prevent that from happening. And we have intensive projects underway, and there are many of most of this work is actually funded by the U.S. Through the National Park Service, because the integrity of Glacier National Park is in, to a great degree dependent on what happens to the north of Glacier Park in British Columbia and Alberta. So we look forward to a discussion on this issue. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Chris. Casey?
Thanks, Sharon. It's great to be here with you all. I'm a resident of Fernie. So as Will said, I'm the Canadian on the panel. But I grew up near where Sharon lives in Toronto. I grew up in Hamilton, Ontario, which was the steelmaking capital of Canada. Still is, but at a greatly reduced rate. But I grew up in the armpit of Canada, and I moved to a paradise. And you know, just to give a bit of an ad for the organization I work for, WildSight, we're a small regional environmental organization. We've been in existence for almost 25 years. Our area is pretty much contiguous with Tenaha First Nations traditional territory, and we were honored and privileged to work with them on conservation issues in that landscape. I'll just sort of put a real fine point on what Chris was mentioning around the lack of social consensus for mining and oil and gas in the Flathead. The company that was proposing this coal mine in the upper headwaters is named Klein, and they actually started the process of an environmental assessment and had some public hearings, and at multiple public hearings, you know, dozens, if not over 100 people came out in very small communities. You know, Fernie's population lower than 5,000 people, and stood up, and people said, you know, I'm a miner, I've been mining for 20 years, I've been mining for 30 years, and I know what mining does to a landscape, and there shouldn't be any mining in the Flathead. And you know, that was just a resounding rejection of this idea. And to the point where the local MLA, who's already been mentioned, who's now the Minister of Energy, Mines, and Petroleum Resources for the province of British Columbia, Bill Bennett, stood up in the legislature in Victoria in the spring of 2008 and said, I don't think my constituents want mining in the Flathead. I don't think there should be mining or energy extraction in the Flathead. So he was actually out ahead of his government on this issue and showed leadership as well. And I think there is some credit that is due there, despite his colorful antics and many other occasions, which I've been at the receiving end of. But I think you kind of got the idea from the previous two speakers, and particularly Chris, that you know, that was a great first step, and it was a very important victory, and it's something that we worked really hard on. But it is a first step, and the job is not done. And there are serious concerns around that long-term connectivity for wildlife north to south. And in the valley that I live in, we're experiencing a lot of money from Calgary coming in and creating that residential sprawl. For so those of you that were in the plenary over breakfast there, that ranchette, death by ranchette problem. And also an expanding industrial footprint in the valley as well. So we have a vision that would complete the Peace Park, the World Heritage Site of Glacier, Waterton Glacier, and add a backcountry to Waterton, which Waterton doesn't really have, by adding about 100,000 acres, 40,000 hectares, the lower one-third of the Flathead Valley, which is that black sort of dark green cross-hatched area in that transboundary Flathead area. And then a wildlife management area, which is existing policy tool, legislative tool, in the BC Wildlife Management Tool Chest, on that light green cross-hatched area, up through the remainder of the Flathead and a few other valleys in the valley that I live in, the Elk Valley. What you don't see on that map there is five giant open pit coal mines mining 25 million tons of coal, the vast majority of it is steelmaking coal every year. And that sort of speaks to one of the key problems that we've had in terms of sort of moving that vision forward. There's super majority, a large majority support for this vision locally. Every time we've asked people, you know, do you want to do more for conservation in this area? Do you support a national park? Very specific questions. Do you support wildlife connectivity? There's large, you know, 70-80% support for doing more for protecting. People recognize that we haven't done enough to protect wildlife in the area. But key constituency for the local MLA and particularly the provincial government is the forestry and the mining industry. They are the largest sponsors of the provincial government financially, of the BC Liberal Party. And they are used to control over land use, and they are used to calling the shots. Quite frankly, Fernie and Sparwood and Elkford, those communities in the Elk Valley wouldn't be there without coal mining. They were established as coal mining towns. But there needs to be balance on the landscape. And the conversation is evolving, but there is still a real imbalance in terms of the way that the provincial government and the people that they listen to, the constituency that they listen to, think about the land and listen to the science. That is very clear and was kind of a big exclamation point was put on it by that UN World Heritage Committee mission, scientific mission that came that Will mentioned, who really highlighted the concern around wildlife connectivity between the two World Heritage sites, the Canada's Rocky Mountain Parks to the north, around Banff, centered around Banff and Waterton Glacier. And something else that needs to be mentioned in all of this is adaptation to climate change going forward, and the concerns around making sure that we're, you know, following the precautionary principle and doing the best we can for these species that we share this area with, not sort of the bare minimum, which is, I think, we haven't even got there yet. I just finished by saying that, the coal that is mined in the Elk Valley has been mined for over 100 years. It's been open pit or strip mined for almost a half a century now, and it's having a very major impact on the watershed in the Elk River. It's changing the chemistry of the Elk River, and it also has a very major carbon footprint. We did an analysis with another environmental organization a few years back. The domestic operations of the coal mine is responsible for about 10% of BC's carbon footprint. If you count the end use, where it gets shipped all over worldwide, it's equivalent to 100% of BC's carbon footprint. So, we've got a big carbon problem in the Elk Valley, and it's kind of BC's dirty secret. You've heard about the tar sands in Alberta and all the environmental problems with that. Well, BC has a really big problem, and they're rapidly expanding coal mining in BC. Not just in the Elk Valley, but up in the Northeast as well. And it's something that you don't really hear about. So it's an interesting side of the story that I'd love to talk about more, but I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you very much. If you've been to an SDG conference before, you know that we ask that members get a chance to ask questions first. And I would ask you to identify yourselves before you ask your question as well. As moderator, I'm going to take the prerogative to ask the first question, if I might. Is this enough, the Memorandum of Understanding and the ban that BC has implemented? I understand logging's still going to be allowed, road building's still going to be allowed, trophy hunting's still going to be allowed. You mentioned this was a first step, Casey, and I don't know who wants to jump in here, but is this going to work?
Well, I think Casey spoke to, if you think about this maybe in the prism of connecting and completing and protecting the world's first peace park, there's still definitely need for connection and completion. And he spoke to that, I think. I think at the international level, there still is a need. If you look at the MOU that Montana and British Columbia signed, I mean, it's a very nice document that expresses a new commitment and vision for the watershed. However, that's not a legally binding document under treaty or international law. I mean, the province of British Columbia and the state of Montana don't have the authority to go out and make foreign policy. And so I think there is a need, and I think the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909 provides an excellent framework for that, to put a federal-to-federal layer on this. It's a binding international agreement that neither party can unilaterally walk away from. So I think that's important. I think that there's continued work on that, and that's ongoing. So at an international level, there's still that need, I believe. And it also, if you look at the report from the UNESCO World Heritage Committee, which, you know, they have a budget sent out about six monitoring missions every year to go to one of the, you know, there's 900 plus World Heritage Sites throughout the world. And these are the world's most special places, whether for natural or cultural reasons. And they selected this park as one of the six sites to do a monitoring mission in 2009, and they really did raise a series of concerns around continued wildlife connectivity and linkage. If you, particularly with Highway 3, which Chris mentioned, you know, we have a situation with Yellowstone National Park where grizzly bears are an island population. The 500 to 600 grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park do not mate and breed with any other grizzly bears in the world. And, you know, is that going to happen with across Highway 3 in the long term if we continue development? I think it's a question. Maybe Chris could speak to it. But, you know, what's the long-term future of connectivity for this World Heritage Site? I think that's a big question. That's going to require international cooperation to ensure that.
Let me say something about this connectivity issue just for a second here. And connectivity across the landscape is critical to the long-term future of terrestrial wildlife species in the Rocky Mountains and elsewhere. And its relationship to climate change is direct, because as climate change proceeds, the distribution and seasonal ranges, distribution of vegetation and seasonal ranges of animals will move across the landscape in location and elevation. And if animals are going to be able to move across the landscape in response to these changes in habitat that will occur with climate change, we have to provide the opportunities for them to move. And so when we have a mountain valley that is filled with human activities, these types of developments block the movement of animals. And these developments and this fragmentation that occurs with them make populations much less resistant and resilient. Resiliency is going to be built and increased by maintaining linkage across the landscape. We are highly invested in this effort across the Rocky Mountains in the U.S. and into Canada. We work on Highway 3 in the Fernie area. We also work on Highway 3 in the Cranbrook area, and then down toward Creston and Stagley Pass over in the Selkirks. I mean, this east-west highway that runs across southern B.C., Highway 3, has the potential to fracture the U.S. populations from their Canadian counterparts. And we are deeply invested in working with our Canadian colleagues to maintain connectivity across Highway 3. If we lose that, we will end up with island populations that are going to be much less resilient to climate change. And so this is a critical climate change issue to maintain connectivity across the landscape, and we're highly invested in this effort.
Yeah, I'll just add that, you know, that this is not a tough idea to understand. I can explain this to someone, this idea of completing the Peace Park and connecting it in about 60 seconds. And people go, okay, I'm with you, I got you. I think 30 seconds for some people. And I have a direct experience with this, with doing tabling in Waterton, and we did tabling in around Glacier Park as well this summer to sign up people to support this vision. We call it Friends of the Flathead. You're all welcome to join. Flatheadwild.com is the place to go to sign up as a friend of the Flathead. But it's not like it's really a tricky concept to grasp. And what we're up against, unfortunately, is people who have want to have their cake and eat it too, who are driven by different values, and they have the ear of both the Alberta and British Columbia governments, unfortunately. And we just have to keep demonstrating to these decision makers that they've made a good start, but they need to keep working, and that there's a political reality that they can't ignore. And that's just real hard sort of advocacy speak from my point of view. But we really do need to put wildlife as a priority on the landscape in this southeast corner of BC, in the along the spine of the Rocky Mountains. That's not the reality now. There are existing tools that would be very easy for the BC government to take off the shelf, and the federal government, the Canadian government, to take off the shelf and use. And it's just a matter of keeping it present politically and socially for them, so that they move in that direction.
I'd open up to questions now. Roger, you had a question to begin with.
Yeah, I guess I'd address this to Will, but any of you can chime in. I'm the photo editor for the SEJ Journal, SC Journal. And actually, we ran a story about a year or so ago, about the International League of Conservation Photographers, who have this campaign they do all various places all over the world called RAISE, which is Rapid Assessment of Digital Conservation. In July of 2009, they organized and ran a parade on the north, I guess you call it the Flathead, I guess in Montana we call it the North Fork, but
yep.
on the same body of water. And subsequently to that was in July of 2009, the events happened to be referring to, sort of the broke the logjam. To what extent was the RAID possibly responsible, or to what extent did it contribute to the, the resolution?
We live in a very visual world. I think the ability to have those images available, and we used multiple platforms to communicate with folks, those images, whether it was the web, a traveling photo exhibit, a film about the photographers. I know the Glacier Group that came up on that tour, I think, watched that film on the bus on the way home. So it really was a very powerful tool, in my opinion. Casey's been working on that a lot, too.
Sure.
I think it's having that stunning visual imagery. You know, they say a picture is worth a thousand words, and I think it's even more true today.
Did that in any way contribute to the resolution? I mean, like a straw on that camel's back or anything like that, you feel? Because they sort of are taking credit for it.
Yeah, it's definitely a part of it. There's definitely, they definitely had a part of it. I mean, to sort of put a highlight on it, I just did an interview for Outside Magazine on that topic. And the way I highlighted the impact was at the signing of the MOU between Governor Schweitzer and Premier Campbell, the backdrop was one of these ILCP raid photos of the Flathead Valley, of the North Fork. So, did it have an impact? Yeah, I mean, they signed they did the ceremony in front of one of the pictures. Yeah, that's pretty powerful. Was it the straw that broke the camel's back? That's tough to say. I mean, it was just such sort of a huge piling on of stuff that, it's a great image. I need to share one of our colleagues. It's like there's this glacier of momentum of scientific evidence and public consensus that's building and building and building, and we keep adding to the top of the glacier, where the snow that keeps adding at the top of the glacier. And you've got Bill Bennett and Premier Campbell at the bottom with hair dryers trying to stop the progress of the glacier.
So it was just in effect, I guess, it's sort of a timing thing. They just happened to do that at the moment when all of this pressure was coming together from 30 years of.
And that was, that was a strategic decision on our part, on the part of the Flathead Wild campaign, to bring that in at that time, because we knew that we had the World Heritage Committee process in play, and we knew that we had, strong political support in a number of quarters in play, and what do we need? We need some really strong visuals. Let's get those now, and we brought that in, and we're able to provide, as Will mentioned, because of the foundation support, we're able to sort of provide the financial backing that needed.
One final point, Roger brought it up, that those images, one, speaking to a room full of journalists, they were available to any, for free, to any journalistic outlet that wanted to use them.
Still available.
Yeah, still available. So, yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Yeah, sorry, the phone is green.
Yeah, my name is Jeff Gales. I'm a journalist from Canada. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Jeff.
I'd like to follow up on your question, because on the U.S. side of the border, we've got the state passing legislation through the political process. In Canada, we have an announcement by the Premier to ban mining, but as far as I know, that's all we have. And maybe you can speak a little more to that, and especially for an American audience about the political process in BC and Canada.
Sure, perfect. So So the Premier of British Columbia is essentially the King of British Columbia for 4 years. We have a parliamentary system democracy. For those of you that don't understand that, it's basically a majority of parliamentarians support a cabinet and a premier who have all the power. There is no sort of bipartisan need for any kind of working together across the aisle, that kind of stuff. It's all the power goes to one party, and they get to make all the decisions. And so as a result of the MOU, actually a couple of what are called orders in council, which are basically executive orders, but have much more power because there is no need, there is no opportunity for legislative challenge and very, very little opportunity for a judicial challenge. So there's been three orders in council have been put in place, which essentially do quarantine almost all mining and oil and gas activities. A funny little piece of wording in the MOU that said that there would continue to be allowed to be rock quarrying in the North Fork and in the flat on the BC side. And so we have this this funny situation where a fellow named Flathead Bob, who's actually the only guy who's ever mined in the Flathead, who's had a decorative rock quarry, who actually has tenures right up through a tributary that has critical transboundary bull trout spawning habitat in it. And he's been given a letter from Minister Bennett saying that you're free to mine, you're free to continue to mine. So all mining is not stopped in the Flathead, but it's just real small, only 20,000 tons a year, only 5 hectares a year can be disturbed. But if you did that for 10 years, you'd put a pretty big hole in the ground, and you certainly would affect, you know, transboundary water quality. And so for some reason, this guy's been exempt, but everybody else has we've been hearing from some of the tenure holders, they've received their letters from the ministry saying, please let us know what your sunk costs are. We'd like to begin a negotiation for compensation. So that's been taken care of. But of course, BC is one of only two jurisdictions in Canada that doesn't have endangered species legislation of any kind. And so there is no protection for individuals or their habitat under BC law. And there is federal legislation, but that only applies to federal government lands and navigable waters, which is the Flathead, but only the main stem of the Flathead.
Fellow there, red t-shirt?
Yep. I'm Eric Bennett from Grizzly Films. We work with National Geographic quite often. This is an area of real interest for us. Chris, I just wonder if you could talk a little bit more scientifically about what, especially what for grizzly bears, why this habitat is so unique and valuable, and you know, what does it have that leads to this specifically this high density of bears in the area, and how does that compare with, you know, the main part of glacier or the main part of Waterton?
Well, the Flathead has a first of all, it doesn't have any site developments in it, so there's really no people living in the Flathead, which is really the biggest, most significant. You know, where you have lots of human development, you have lots of site conflicts, and you have attractants which get bears into trouble, and disturbance which drives bears out of key habitats. But the Flathead isn't anybody living in it. That's a key thing. And another thing about the Flathead is that there were fires in there about 50 to 60 years ago, and those fires created huge huckleberry fields, which created huge food resources for grizzly bears in that area. And of interest is the fact that we're seeing the grizzly bear density now start to decline as the area starts to grow up again and huckleberry crops start to decline. And the huckleberries in that area have been key to the high density of grizzly bears in that place. And so over time, if fire doesn't replace some of the huckleberry crops, eventually we'll see a decline in grizzly bear density in the Flathead. So the unique nature of the Flathead is a lack of site development with no humans living in there, and then that history of fire which created a tremendous density of resources in that area. Some places have a very high density of huckleberries, which contributes to a high density of grizzlies. And the comparison to Glacier in Waterton, Glacier's had similar fire history in some places where there's been some good productivity for huckleberries in certain places, but in many areas those are declining. We get back to this history of fire management in the West, you know, where we try and prevent fire from happening. And fire is a really key feature that promotes diversity of habitats on the landscape and produces foods for animals like bears and produces winter range for ungulates. So fire management or fire suppression in many cases has reduced wildlife population densities across the landscape, and it's important to have fire as a natural regime on the landscape. So,
if I can add just a couple of points to that, you know, Canada is a lot different than the United States in terms of population pressures, and that's one of the things that, you know, Chris was sort of alluding to there. But I mean, it's a really unique experience in southern Canada. There's only 34 million of us, but we're all, you know, 85% of us are within 200 kilometers of your border. Or of the Canada-U.S. border. And so it's a very unique experience to climb a peak in the Flathead Valley and look out over a very large landscape and not see that, oh, that's where the humans are doing that, or that's where the road goes, or that's where the, you know, that's where the town is, or that's where the ranch is. Like, you can't really do that anywhere else along the Canada-U.S. border and have that view of a landscape that large. So, you know, this isn't just special kind of locally here or important for the United States. This is special in Canada, and that's what, you know, I think really makes it of global significance. And I'll just add something to what Dr. Savino was talking about in terms of the fire. And, you know, in 2003 we had a really bad fire, or sorry, 2003 we had a really bad fire year, and fires were being allowed to burn in Glacier. And on the Canadian side, they put in a fire break about three bulldozer blades wide, really quickly, really, you know, badly, haphazardly, sloppily, to protect the most important resource on the Canadian side in the North Fork, which was the timber. And it sort of worked, and weather helped and stuff too. But that's the sort of what the land is being managed for right now. And the impact of forestry, and we work with the local forestry operator, industrial forestry operator. They're FSC certified. We are their NGO partner on Forest Stewardship Council certification. But something I just learned from another colleague, that the difference between the nutrient loading from a fire-affected landscape versus a forested landscape, or log landscape, is amazing. You know, nutrient loading on a creek is almost down to undetectable after 5 years after a fire. In 30 years of measurement by scientists at the Flathead Lake Biological Station just up the road here, they still haven't detected. They still are detecting nutrient loading in logged landscapes.
Can you explain what you mean by the nutrient loading specifically?
Can I put you on the spot? Can you get on that, or do you want me to go ahead?
I think you should go ahead.
Sure.
Outside my realm.
Sure.
Expertise.
So, you know, after a fire or after logging, there's a lot of increased erosion and increased sedimentation in the stream from that. But there's also increases of nitrogen, natural fertilizers,
okay,
basically, in the system.
You're talking about in the stream.
In the stream itself.
Absolutely.
In the stream itself, which has, you know, significant effects on the aquatic ecosystem. And so those effects are that reduced to not detectable within about 5 years, a decade after a fire. But they aren't reduced. They're still detectable 3 decades later after industrial logging.
Whereas after a fire, they tend to go back into the earth.
Yeah, there's just the way the vegetation comes back, the way, you know, the lack of the sedimentation that, you know, you continue to get from the persistence of roads and those things and in industrial forestry areas and those kind of things. Yeah, there's a huge number of factors.
Okay, Francis?
Let me make one other comment before that question, and that is the unique nature of the Flathead on the Canadian side, that it's not developed. Almost every large valley in the Rocky Mountains is developed by humans. Highways in it, it has settlements in it, it has houses, ski resorts, you name it. Almost every one is built. This upper flathead drainage in the Canadian side does not have that type of development. We're not making those kinds of landscapes anymore. And if we lose that one, then we would lose one of the last ones that is undeveloped. And our big problem with habitat fragmentation across the landscape is the human developments in every mountain valley in the Rocky Mountains. That fractures the mountains. And you can see all kinds of pristine wild country up in the hills, but when the animals come down, they've got to cross those highways, those developments, county risk factor for them. And they either die trying to do it or they don't do it at all.
There is a road in the water, though.
Sorry, Roger, I just want to give other people a chance to ask questions.
Well, water comes on the other side, though. So the flathead is, it's got a road in it, but it's not a paved road, and it doesn't have human houses and towns in it.
And historically, is that just a fluke that this particular valley?
You got to go over the top to get in there because the drainage flows south, and getting over the top in the wintertime is really difficult. And so nobody built anything. There was a flathead town site years ago in there, but it's been abandoned at this point. So there's no site development. There's no humans that live in the flathead all year long. That is critically important to the ecosystem that's there.
Frances?
I'm Frances Backhouse. I'm a BC-based journalist, and I've had the good fortune to go into the flathead. I'd like you to speak to the controversy around the national park expansion proposal. You kind of downplayed it a bit, I think, Casey, when you were saying that there's a lot of support for the protection. And certainly when I was covering this a few years ago, there were a lot of people who were opposed to the proposal to expand the national park. And I'd be surprised if those people aren't still opposed to it. And even, there's people who want it still to be their own private recreation area, but there's also people like Chris Servine's Canadian colleague, Bruce McClellan, who's expressed concerns to me about the human activity that would come in with a national park and what that would do to the bear populations. And so it seems like a very simple thing to just expand the national park and make this part of it, but we know it's not so simple. I'd like to hear from all of you on that.
There's certainly opposition. We conducted random digidial polling, telephone polls, in the fall of 2008 and the fall of 2009. And when you get people at home, in the comfort of their own home, not in the public place, and you ask them their opinion of this, you get over 60% support for a national park in the Flathead, in our region, not across BC, but in the East Kootenay, so Cranbrook and the Elk Valley. The polling says that there's about, that same polling shows there's about 20% adamantly opposed, strongly opposed to the national park. And those folks are, they're pretty dug in. They're loud about it. And, you know, they unfortunately are some of Mr. Bennett's core constituents. And unfortunately, Mr. Bennett has used misinformation to stoke fear on this issue. He claims that we want the entire Flathead Valley to be a park, and that's not true. He claims that it would shut out all traditional activities, and that's not true either. A couple of things, you know, it was just mentioned that Waterton has paved roads up both major valleys. And, you know, Waterton was established over 100 years ago under a different mandate for national parks to open up, you know, the wilderness for people to be able to come in and experience it. Waterton doesn't have that much backcountry. It does have some, but it doesn't have that much backcountry. This would be a backcountry for Waterton National Park, similar to what Banff and Jasper and Kootenay-Yoho have. Over 80% of those parks are designated as wilderness, which means you can't have anything other than tent pads and outhouses developed. And that's what we would strongly advocate for the entire Flathead National Park to be. So people could drive to the border and walk from there. And that would make a huge difference, I think, in terms of the human impact. Because right now, you know, and particularly this last summer, we saw a lot of people coming from all over the place, locally as well as up through Alberta, and on quads and 4x4s, and coming to see the Flathead. We heard about the Flathead. We want to come and see it before it turns into a national park. I actually heard that this summer. There's over a million people living in Calgary now. You know, there were half that when I first moved to this area. So there's a lot more population pressure in the immediate area, and a lot of those people are choosing to recreate in ways that aren't necessarily all that conducive to long-term habitat security. There's another part to the question that I'm not sure if I've asked.
I think we've kind of.
Okay.
Francis, just looking at the broader ecosystem of the crown of the continent, which is really the temperate headwaters of North America, you can see when you look at the protected areas map, the vast majority, over 80%+ of the protected areas and ecosystem are on the U.S. side. There are no wildlife sanctuaries in Southeast British Columbia. So I mean, I think there is a, going back to the long-term vision around ecological integrity for this part of the world, there is a need to continue that dialogue. It's easy for folks on the U.S. side of the border to say, we love Glacier National Park, and obviously expanding it would be great. You know, Glacier is about 8 times larger than Waterton. It is interesting, you know, you go back, Glacier celebrated its 100th anniversary this year, as I mentioned, and the local newspaper, you know, there's a great quote, it says, 100 years ago, they said, I'm sure there's one or two people who support the creation of this park in this area. We can't find them. And now when you go to the Yellow Pages and open it up and look for businesses, there's over 200 businesses that have Glacier in their name. And our high school is named Glacier, you know, Glacier Wolfpack, that's interesting. The wolves, too. But so, I mean, there is this, you know, I think this inherent inertia around some of these social decisions. But often when you make the decision in the long run, you know, the benefits become readily self-evident to future generations.
Yeah, and I'll just pick up on that. You know, we commissioned an economics study in 2005 that showed that there would be about a $1.4 million annual GDP bounce provincially and particularly regionally if Flathead National Park went ahead. And, you know, we sort of trotted that around to local business people as well as the provincial government and stuff. And, you know, the universal response from folks sort of in the tourism industry or the even the development industry, folks that are making money off amenity migrants, they said, oh yeah, we get that. That's a no-brainer for us, but don't ask us to step out publicly on this because the MLA is such a bully, to be quite frank, and our position in this community would suffer because of the way he's sort of positioned on this issue. So,
just for the Americans in the audience, MLA is Member of Legislative Assembly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's this intimidation factor from a very loud minority of folks who are really sort of ruling the day right now, unfortunately. And it's a continued problem for us, but we're working on it slowly and or as aggressively as we can, but it's a slow change.
I guess the other piece of the question was also about, specifically about bears and National Park. And
okay.
Whether it would be a good thing or a bad thing for the bears.
Well, if I could speak for Bruce, who's a colleague of mine, his concern is that if there's a park on that side, then there would be pressures to have a visitor center and to improve the road and to bring more people in and to establish campgrounds, and it might result in more people and more human activity in that area. And that's the worry that he has, is that the park would just create more draw and more facilities in the Flathead, which doesn't have any at this point.
And that's really why, that really puts a big exclamation point on why it's not just the national park, but it's the wildlife management area as well, so the complete and connect. And so the wildlife management area would be a management plan that had very specific management guidelines, species-based management guidelines. So you'd have fish, trout, and grizzly bears would certainly be two of the key species there. And so that would sort of put a restriction on what is essentially all land, provincial crown land is what we call it. It's the land owned by the residents of British Columbia, and would be able to sort of have sensible management and not have the sort of gold rush mentality that can result sometimes from a new tourism attraction being brought to an area.
Monica?
Hi, I'm Monica Jordan, so I'm an environment reporter at the Edmonton Journal. Chris, you mentioned the body of science that was collected to support the protection of the Flathead Valley. And I was just wondering if you could go into a little more detail on that. I heard a little bit about that on a tour to the Flathead Bay Biological Research Station. And interestingly enough, the scientists sort of described how he essentially snuck across the border and took water samples. You know, he's like stealth science. So I was also wondering how much buy-in or support you have from Canadian colleagues across the border.
Okay, that's a good question. There is a significant body of science that is available, and it's related to water quality issues, to fisheries issues, and terrestrial wildlife issues. The water quality work was done by the folks at the Flathead Lake Biological Station, and they were up there doing the sampling. And I don't know that they were sneaking across the border because I was up there with them sometimes and I wasn't sneaking around. So we seem to be fairly evident. But the BC folks weren't involved in that, in the water quality work. And there was some fisheries work as well. And they were going up and sampling some of the fish, trying to figure out what species were in certain streams and whether there was bull trout spawning sites or not in certain areas. And there was not a lot of BC involvement in that process. I'm not aware that the BC folks ever inhibited any of our scientific work in any way. And the third branch of the work was the terrestrial work. And I was the lead in the terrestrial work. And we had excellent cooperation from the BC scientists that are in the area, Bruce McClellan and various other folks in the Ministry of Environment. Were in all ways very cooperative with us. And they did not participate in the work that we did, but when we needed permits for wolverine trapping or something like that, we were granted those permits right away. So we had good cooperation with our BC colleagues. And it's important to realize that for 30 years, we've been working closely with our BC colleagues. So this wasn't the first time we've been up there. We've been working in the Flathead for 30 years. We in the U.S. have been working across the border for 30 years. I have field crews that work in British Columbia each year trapping bears in BC, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service crews. And we do that with the full cooperation of the BC government. So we have real good transboundary cooperation. You know, it kind of put them in a difficult spot because we were gathering information to show that the potential mine in BC was going to be a negative impact. So they had to somewhat distance themselves from what we were doing so it didn't look like the BC government employees were gathering information against their government's decision. But they were in all ways cooperative with us doing it and allowing us to do that. So, I mean, I didn't see any inhibition from the BC folks. And, you know, it's remarkable, and I need to comment here, is that the BC government, when they were doing this environmental assessment of the potential mine that was up there, they allowed us, the U.S. delegation, which included myself and folks from Montana State, folks from the National Park Service and the Biological Station folks, they allowed us to participate in those discussions and those meetings as full participants. So they could have easily said, no, this is a BC issue and you U.S. guys get out. But they left it open, and we attended all those with the mining proponents and discussed this stuff and presented our concerns, and they were very open about that. And that's to their credit.
And I'll just jump in. I mean, the fact of the matter is that without the science from the U.S. side, there would have been little for us to advocate as a basis for advocacy. The lack of resources on the Canadian side, particularly in British Columbia, being dedicated towards science and management, wildlife management, is really frightening. It's astonishing. So there is a very small provincial park right up against the border, Akamina-Kishinina Provincial Park. It's about 11,000 hectares. They have 0.4 of a full-time equivalent for all of the management needs of that park area. That includes doing ranger work, doing any kind of trail work, doing any kind of wildlife management work. So less than a half of a person for a year for an 11,000 hectare park. That's what we're looking at in BC in terms of the level of resource there. So, you know, I can speak for the advocacy community and for the folks that we include as our supporters. There is a very humble, thankful feeling towards the U.S. scientists.
And we continue to work up there. I want to emphasize that. We've got an active program on grizzly bears and on wolverines in the upper Flathead and on the Highway 3 area right now, and with full cooperation from our BC colleagues. So we're working up there, and it's a transboundary effort and good cooperation with our colleagues.
I am Selina Palacio with Voice of America Television in Washington. I'm not familiar with the region at all. This is my first time here. But I would like to hear a little bit more about the richness of the area. How valuable is it, and for how long are we going to be able to keep protecting this?
I should just pull it up here, because I think there's a working paper that was completed by the Wildlife Conservation Society. It's the Transboundary Flathead, a critical landscape for carnivores in the Rocky Mountains. So if you guys are looking for a primary source document, I think that's one of the most tremendous synthesis of of information that's been done. And I'll just, I might pull this really quickly. There's this one sentence in the summary here where it says, due to the unique characteristics and its strategic position as a linkage between national parks in both countries, the Transboundary Flathead may be the single most important basin for carnivores in the Rocky Mountains. So really you have this convergence of factors that lend to the significance. It's location on the continental level at a climactic mixing zone, where you see this particular valley being the southern extent of more northern species and the northern extent of more southern species. I think in total there's 13 different large and mid-sized carnivores in the valley.
Sixteen.
So, yeah, a real diversity of species exists there. And like Chris was saying, you have this, the valley floor is at 3,000, a little over 3,000 feet above sea level, and the tops of your highest peaks are at just under 10,000. So you really have this tremendous elevational gradient that's entirely pretty much occupied by carnivores and their prey. You don't have that large human footprint like you do here in the Missoula Valley right along the banks of the river. So
but how about minerals?
Minerals?
Yes.
Oh, as far as
lots
the...
of minerals.
Yeah, I mean...
that was my...
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about the values. The resources there, as far from a mining perspective, at the very headwaters of the valley, there's really some amazing coal resources. It's the Crow's Nest coal field. The southern portion of that coal field spans the hydrological divide between the Flathead and the Elk.
Billions of dollars.
Yeah, cool. There's some trace gold. There's some historical oil exploration that's been gone, but I think the greatest proven resource in the valley is coal.
Billions.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, this is not a significant thing that the BC government has given up in terms of future mining opportunities for this valley. There was a lot at stake. Current market conditions probably not favorable to mining most of that coal. It's buried very deeply. And we've just seen the result of underground mining, a very dramatic thing that the whole world paid attention to in Tilley there. But given a certain price and given a certain market demand, anything can become economic. The quality of the resource is certainly there.
There's 140 million tons of proven coal reserves in the Flathead that we know, and then there's gold reserves as well. So it's not a trivial matter what BC did in suspending mining there. But will it be suspended forever? That's a good question.
And do they have the money to buy out those exploration licenses?
No.
Other questions?
I was just looking at the map of this proposed wildlife management area. What's the situation there? Oh, sorry, I'm Katie Younger. I'm with the Wildlife Society. I write about it for their member magazine. I'm just curious what activities would go on there. Who would be managing that area?
So, under other wildlife management areas in British Columbia, no specific activity is restricted. No traditional use is restricted. But management objectives are set for various key species, and different land use management tools or restrictions can be brought in different pieces, different areas of that landscape in order to protect habitat and in order to protect species. So right now in that area, it's called the Southern Rocky Mountain Management Plan. There are what are called access management areas, which restrict motorized access. There are also private conservancies owned by the Nature Conservancy of Canada. And there are also other different types of restrictions that are mostly voluntary based through the Forest Stewardship Council certification process that have established endangered forest areas. That are basically handshake agreements between the timber companies that own the tenure and ourselves, that they won't log in old growth areas and riparian areas and things like that. So there's a number of different management tools and different landscape treatments that are happening already. Those would all be driven by a legislative framework that puts species and wildlife first, if it was to become a wildlife management area. Right now it's basically all politics. and different social and economic and political pressures at play. And the overriding, as I said in my opening remarks, the overriding value is mining. And in fact, in the Southern Rocky Mountain Management Plan, in one of the outsetting chapters, it says, you know, you're going to hear a lot about wildlife connectivity, old growth management, riparian protection, ungulate winter range, all sorts of different, basically, GIS management layers are part of this plan. Mining and oil and gas trumps all of those values everywhere in this plan area, is what the plan says now. We don't think that's balanced.
Christine?
Yeah, Christine Heinex, I'm an independent journalist running at Sustainable Agriculture and Wildlife. We just came out of a meeting in which these very similar issues were, the positions were discussed. Dan was saying that we need to move beyond arguing positions into stating concerns in order to move this discussion forward. How do you see this discussion moving off this very polarized and difficult political and social discussion?
Oh, we just did a big round of that through engaging with the UN and the World Heritage Committee and sort of getting some adult supervision in into the discussion and some broader perspective. And that broader perspective was really helpful and basically said, yeah, this is a really friggin' important world-class resource and you guys got to do better. And I think that's kind of one, that in terms of straws breaking camels' backs, that was probably really the one that did it in terms of, you know, BC's concern right around the Olympics of a big public black eye. The UN calls out BC's management in the transboundary Rockies, and you know, lots of big brands at play there, to use that kind of language. And we will continue to sort of just try and increase the volume and increase the awareness of the international significance of this area and the need to sort of overcome the provincial sort of parochial attitudes that we're faced with in our valley.
Just to follow up on that, again, was that part of the World Heritage Review process or was that a different U.S.?
Yeah, so we petitioned, nine environmental groups petitioned the UN World Heritage Committee to consider listing Watterson Glacier as a World Heritage Site in danger because of the mining proposals in the headwaters in British Columbia.
And that's review you're referring to as the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, and I think just, you know, that was a specific strategy that we pursued that had all sorts of strategic timing elements to it and whatnot, but I think it was, you know, it was a very significant factor in the success, but I wouldn't downplay the you know, the individual leadership and the sort of the political, institutional, scientific support for it that sort of held all of that up to
be
able
to make the decision before the action of the project.
So the resolution from the report was accepted at the World Heritage Committee's meeting in Brasilia this year, and they commended BC and Montana for taking the action and the MOU and the orders in council that I mentioned earlier. But they have also, as Will said, highlighted that strong sort of exclamation point with a climate change, you know, note attached to it, the concerns around wildlife connectivity. And that's something that they said we are going to continue to keep an eye on this.
You know, going back to, you know, the controversy, and I think this is where I think you do see the difference perhaps in how this issue is viewed across the 49th parallel. You know, I grew up in northwest Montana here, and there's a hotbed of, you know, UN and, you know, fear. We're in the center of it for sure. And, you know,
The black helicopter,
the blue helmets speak, you know, and it's really been fascinating to me as we've seen this issue go forward, both at the state level, all the way up to the international level, how there hasn't been that pushback. I mean, there hasn't been the letters to the editors saying the UN shouldn't be involved here. And there is this strong sense of consensus around the issue. And part of that may be politics of gravity, right? The US has everything to lose and nothing to gain. But really, if there's something I've learned from this entire experience, it's this, the importance of stories and what we tell each other. I mean, the story that Glacier National Park has in the culture of Montana and our national parks have in both countries is so powerful. And when you look at Waterton Glacier as the world's first peace park, the world's first formally designated protected area to span an international border. That's powerful. And, you know, we talk about science and we think about, you know, what our strategic advisors tell us in the halls of Washington or in the halls of Victoria. But really, I think, and this is, you know, such a role of journalism as the first draft of history is, you know, what are the stories we're telling ourselves around these landscapes and these places? And I think that really trumps everything. And that's just a lesson I've taken out of this entire experience, for sure.
Any other questions? Sorry,
I'll just jump on that just really briefly as an anecdote. I'm a Rotarian. I'm actually president of the Fernie Rotary Club this year. And I just did a tour this summer of 18 different Rotary Clubs, sort of from Minneapolis east, on a family trip, kind of combined a little bit of travel and a little bit of meeting with Rotarians and stuff. And, you know, I'd get up in front of Rotarians and do like a 20-minute spiel with a slideshow and trying to let people know and sign them up as friends of the Flathead. And, you know, when I talked about the Peace Park and that being a legacy, the Rotarians actually that came up with the idea. And that got the most sort of nods and the ahas. That power story is just, it really is quite an incredible legacy that's been created here for the world. And BC has this opportunity to become part of this great story. And they're basically just giving the big middle finger to it right now. And it's just mind-boggling to anybody that I can talk to that's outside of the valley that I live in, basically. Really is quite amazing, the refusal to embrace this opportunity from, you know, and in large part because of, you know, one individual and his core constituents who are just not willing to accept or embrace the opportunity that this is being presented.
Because they have a different narrative, as you pointed out.
Absolutely.
There it is, yeah.
Anybody else have any questions? If not, then thank you very much for coming. There's a half-hour break before the next session. Coffee, treats, and therapy.